Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of August. Ronald Bailey is a science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com, where he writes a weekly science and technology column. He is the author of Liberation Biology, The Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution. He's also been a staff writer for Forbes magazine, articles appearing in many major national publications, has produced several weekly national public television series, Think Tank and Technopolitics, and also documentaries for PBS and ABC. A piece that he wrote on July 29 in Reason magazine, Al Gore's curiously cost-free plan to repower America, calculating the cost of 100% renewable carbon-free energy in 10 years, caught our attention. And he says that who's going to pay for this marvelous no-carbon energy future, and how much will it cost? He says he decided to don his green eyeshade and make a preliminary stab at figuring out how much Gore's scheme might cost us. And it's a lot of money. So we will talk about this issue this hour of the show with Ronald. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, I know you love energy issues, that is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Hello, Ronald.
Hello. Delighted to be with you.
Thank you very much for being with us. You've calculated that the existing capacity of coal, gas, oil generating plants total around 850,000 megawatts. Is that a lot?
That's basically somewhere in the neighborhood of 85% of our energy, basically.
So that's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
Of our electricity, I should say, not oil and so forth, but basically of our electricity.
Yeah. So how did you figure out how much it would cost to replace all of our facilities with solar electric power, with wind, and with geothermal electricity? Is it hard to get to those figures?
It is kind of hard to get to those figures because we have so little of those kinds of energy supplies out there currently. So what I tried to do was go around and find some costs for some proposed plants and various types. I decided not to do solar voltaic because that's relatively very expensive. But a very promising solar technology is solar thermal, which basically what you do is you heat up water or other substances using very powerful mirrors that are focused on one point. And a lot of those plants are being proposed for California currently. So I looked at some of the cost figures for that and then used those to back it out. If we were going to replace everything with that kind of electricity, how much would that cost? And basically, you know, and did the same thing for wind power and for geothermal power. And also I decided to throw in nuclear power, even though the former vice president didn't mention that. It is also a carbon-free energy source, so I wanted to throw that in as well. And so if you'd like, I could go through the various
calculations. Yes, please do. Please do.
Well, looking at the solar thermal, what I basically came up to was looking at a particular plant that's being built in Arizona for $1 billion. You net out all those costs. It would cost $3 trillion to replace all carbon-generated electricity with new solar energy power. So it would be $3 trillion over the next 10 years. Then I looked at wind energy, and I decided that T. Boone Pickens, as you know, has been making quite a splash with his new proposal to build the world's biggest wind energy project in Texas. And if you go back to his numbers and add it all up, it would be about $6 trillion if you were to replace all of the carbon-generated energy over the next 10 years. And then I looked at geothermal, and that's the most speculative because the type of plant that people are thinking about building basically would require, there are a lot of hot rocks. If you dig down several kilometers, a lot of places have very hot rocks. And the idea here is you would dig a borehole on one end, fracture the rocks down there, and then shoot down some cold water and have it warm up and then come out another borehole with steam and would turn turbines and so forth. And there are some very preliminary plants being built around the world trying to test this out. But again, assuming that this will actually work out, and the numbers are correct, that would cost about $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years if we were supposed to replace everything with geothermal energy. And because I used low numbers for all of these as well, I tried to use very conservative numbers. I didn't want to use the more outrageous figures, so I was coming to a low figure here. I also used low numbers to calculate what the nuclear power, if we were to replace all of the carbon-based energy, electricity generation with nuclear, how much that would be, and that would be about $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. So those are the numbers I came up with, and if you look at it, a kind of general implication is that in order to achieve Al Gore's goal, it would cost about $300 billion a year in order to replace all of our carbon energy production, electricity production, with solar, geothermal, or wind.
And in, at least in the case of wind and solar, these are, you know, around. We got the wind, we got the sun. Why in the world is it so expensive to make a conversion? Where is the cost?
It's the capital cost. It's not the fuel cost. One of the things that Gore is right about is once you get these things up and running, the energy is a lot cheaper. You don't have to keep mining coal. You don't have to burn natural gas, those kinds of things, which are the largest cost, actually, of producing electricity now. And so once these are up, the fuel would be cheap. But the capital costs are much greater than for coal or natural gas generating plants currently. And one of the other problems that he doesn't mention and is that if we were to go on such a crash program as this, it would also probably drive up these costs. When I said these are minimal costs, these are the conservative estimates on my part. If we went on a crash program, the amount of concrete, steel, the amount of technology that has to go into all of this would drive up the commodity prices a lot higher and probably make these estimates a lot higher eventually.
Mm-hmm. So by the capital cost, you mean all of the structures, all of the
structures, right? The right. Turbines, the, mm-hmm. the drilling of the holes, the connections to the electricity grids, the wind turbines, and or the mirrors and that kind of thing.
Do you think it's something simply because of the volatility of the oil market and the politics involved in all of this and the fact that we may have reached peak oil, et cetera, that we simply are going to somehow have to pay for that kind of conversion and find the trillions of dollars that would be necessary?
Well, it's interesting to contemplate. I have no doubt that our civilization will not be fueled by oil. By the end of this century, probably not even by 2050, and we will have to make this transition. The question is do we have to make the transition in a rapid 10-year proposal, or do we have 40 years to do it? The former vice president, obviously thinks that climate change is such a huge problem that we have to go on a crash program. But on the other hand, there are other people, such as William Nordhaus, who's an economist who's been working on these issues for the last 20 years, who thinks that we have a much longer transition time and that, in fact, we'll probably end up with technologies like these, but we don't need a crash program for it.
Uh-huh. So we could do it over a longer period of time.
Right, which would lower the cost considerably over that period of time as well.
Right. Tell me also about some of the other things that we might be doing in order to save a little bit of money to make this kind of conversion. I'm sure you saw Bob Herbert's column a couple days ago, or maybe just yesterday, that looked at California now among the lowest of all the states in the per capita consumption of energy. And it would have, if you took autos out of the picture, the lowest per capita consumption of any state, because they simply are making sure that appliances sold in California are much more efficient. They're much more concerned about conservation, et cetera. Are there things that we should be looking at that would allow us to save some money to move to what we eventually have to move to?
Well, I was very puzzled by that Bob Herbert column because the one thing he failed to mention was a glaring hole in his argument, is California has the highest electricity rates in the country. The reason people conserve in California is not just because of the appliance standards and so forth that he cited, but because they're paying a lot of money. And so they are encouraged to buy more efficient appliances and air conditioning and heating and whatever. And so it was just a puzzle to me that he wouldn't mention the fact that basically the Californians pay twice as much as people in probably Wisconsin do for their electricity. And that's fine. And in fact, if you want to raise energy prices, that is the way to cause people to broadly conserve the use of energy. That's what happens with anything that we do. For example, as you well know, as I'm sure your listeners know, the United States is consuming a lot less gasoline than it was a year or two ago because the price of gasoline went up.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a policy that we want to adopt broadly? Do you think a politician is going to be elected on a platform, I promise to double the price of gasoline and your electric bill?
Yeah, probably not. Are there everyday good energy deeds, though, that would make a difference?
Well, there probably are, and I think that more Americans are moving in that direction. I mean, my wife and I are, for example, slowly but surely replacing, our incandescent bulbs with the new CFLs, the compact fluorescents,
mm-hmm.
and that will definitely make a difference over time. And the price of CFLs, because more and more of them being made, in fact, are going down, and they're becoming better and more efficient. You no longer have that ghastly truck stop bathroom look anymore when you turn them on.
Yeah, right. They don't look very good. You're absolutely. We have some in the house that are just they have this horrible color to them.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
But no, and of course, I have to say Barack Obama is correct about you should definitely make sure your tires are properly inflated. I don't care what John McCain says about that. But again, these are at the margins. These kinds of personal activities, if climate change is a huge problem, and most people believe that it is, that's not going to really solve the problem. They're going to have to be transformations in the way we produce energy more broadly.
So where's the good place to start? What's the cheapest place to start?
Well, if my numbers are correct, and I don't really, I want to say these are very preliminary calculations. The easiest and simplest thing for us to do would be use a proven technology now, proven low-carbon electric generation technology, and that would be nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not moving in that direction for obvious reasons politically, but that would be the first easiest step for us to take.
Mm-hmm.
Another step that is probably going to happen, and we already see this going on, especially if gas prices remain higher, is that there'll be a switch over time toward hybrid vehicles, and the plug-in electric hybrid vehicles that are probably coming online in the next decade or so will make a big difference in, eventually a big difference, not immediately, in the amount of oil that we import from foreign countries.
And are there a lot of countries in the world who are way ahead of us on, not the nuclear, but on the cars, Ronald?
There are a lot of countries that have a very relatively fuel-efficient car fleet. And again, if you look across the world, you'll find out why pretty quickly, is that in Europe, typically gasoline costs twice what it costs
mm-hmm.
here, largely because of taxes. And thus, the people in Europe have two. First of all, the countries are much smaller and therefore more compact. They don't have to drive as long a distance as many Americans do. But the other thing is that they're paying a lot more for their fuel, and therefore are therefore encouraged to conserve on that. And again, if this is certainly a policy that we could adopt in the United States, I just wonder how politically viable that is.
Mm-hmm. And what about nuclear? Are these hurdles just the fear that Americans have of danger with nuclear power that we're just not going to be able to move beyond that?
That's a very good question. The polls are showing more interest lately by the public in nuclear power. I actually am not a huge booster of nuclear power because I do wonder about whether or not it's cost effective in the sense of storing the waste of nuclear power generation. And the other thing is the insurance costs. Would, in fact, these things have to be guaranteed by the government? If they're guaranteed by the government, does that somehow, is that a subsidy that we don't want to give to this form of energy? But on the flip side, of course, every proponent that I know of solar, wind and geothermal power wants massive government subsidies for their favorite form of power, too. So, you know, it's just a political question at that point. It really isn't a kind of a market question.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Ronald, and we'll take them in a moment. Ronald Bailey is our guest, science correspondent for Reason magazine, and a piece that he wrote on July 29th in Reason caught our attention. Al Gore's curiously cost-free plan to repower America, calculating the cost of 100% renewable carbon-free energy in 10 years. Here's our number. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. Email address. And if you could write your emails just a little shorter, we have some emails that are just really long and I can't read them all. So try to be succinct. Thank you. And that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Ronald, and let's start with Nate from Mazamani. Hi, Nate.
Good morning, Kathleen, and your guest. First, I'd just like to make a little brief comment about I saw a program here maybe a month or so ago, that Germany already has approximately a third of their energy being generated by solar, and that was a program that has been in development for over about 30 years, I understand. And the other thing is we had a shot across our bow in the 70s that energy was a big issue, and it seems like it was pretty much blown off by the society as a whole. A few leaders kind of said, hey, we've got to do something, but I think that pointed up the fact that you really got to have a critical mass of people paying attention to this, or it easily slips away. Here's my question. When I wrote down all those figures that you cited, which I assume is in current day dollars.
That's right.
If we would have done this 30 years ago, I would assume the price tag would have been considerably less. If we do this 30 years from now, I would assume it's going to be considerably more. So I wonder, when we talk about the dollars involved here, if we shouldn't discuss that issue.
Okay. A couple of things. Let's talk about that specifically. Then I want to say something about what's going on in Germany. But if we tried to do this 30 years ago, many of these technologies simply didn't exist. And in fact, it would have been impossible, really, to roll them out. And if we had tried to do something like that, for example, if we'd picked solar energy power of its type 30 years ago, we would probably be stuck with very expensive, very inefficient versions of that. Over time, what's happened, of course, is that further research by inventors and entrepreneurs has taken place. And, in fact, the prices of these technologies are, in fact, coming down from what they used to be. The argument that a lot of people make, for example, the economist William Nordhaus at Yale that I cited earlier, is that further research over time will also bring down these costs eventually, and that if we deploy these technologies, not in a crash program, but over a 30 to 40-year time period, the overall cost would probably be considerably less. And I think he's probably right about that. With regard to the situation in Germany, again, what happened is that the Germans mandated that there be a certain amount of power produced by renewable sources, and part of what they did was, and it's a very complicated system I won't go into, but basically nowhere near a third of the energy is being produced by solar. I don't know what it is, but I would be surprised if it was over 10 or 15
really?
Percent. Yeah, nowhere near a third. But what's interesting is, again, and this is all possible, again, if you're willing to pay more. Germans pay considerably more for electricity than we do. And if you want to pay that, then you can have these technologies. And this is the point that I want the listeners to clearly understand. The technologies are there, but it will cost you more than you're paying now. If you have to decide if that's what you want.
And thank you very much for your call. Wayne is our next caller. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. Good to hear your voice, Kathleen.
Thanks, Wayne.
Go Brett, go Packers.
Wayne, please.
I love you both. Yeah. Ron, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I come from a more practical point of view, not that you don't, but I live on a small farm. And,
I grew up on a small farm, by the way.
2 years ago from a company that provided a service we felt was necessary for their functioning and meeting all of the EPA standards, and particularly foundries. My question is, I have a couple tractors, and I was always referred to as a night farmer around here because I worked full-time during the day and came home at night, and you'd see my headlights in the fields trying to get the ground ready to go and what you all have to do on the farm. But my question is, I still rely on gas and oil to get those tractors running and the combines and all I need to perform my duties. And the companies I called on also needed those kinds of energy resources. Some of the blast furnaces had to get up to 800 to 1,000 degree Fahrenheit or greater. My question is, I cannot mount a solar panel or windmill on my tractor. That tractor has got to run at 9 o'clock at night sometimes, not anymore because I'm retired. But in a practical world, how does industry and this is a farming state as New York, California, and Iowa, Illinois, and many others, how do farmers and industrial folks rely on solar or wind? If there's no wind and there's no sun for a week, what do they do? And I'm trying to learn here. That's my point.
Okay. Well, and it's a very good point. A couple of ways to look at what is likely to happen with the evolution of energy over time. A technological solution to your problem will be I'm actually going to be doing some reporting on this pretty soon, is that we'll need to have some way, better way of storing electricity that is generated by solar, wind, or thermal. And so the hope would be, though it is not there yet, is that your tractors and combines might be run by electric batteries at some point and electric motors. But that's still a ways away. What is likely to happen is that the shift toward electric vehicles will take place with regard to our cars and our trucks. And what will happen, and the hope will be, again, is that the prices of liquid fuels, liquid transport fuels, fossil fuels like gasoline and diesel and so forth, will go down because there'll be less and less demand for that, and in fact will be switched over to supporting agricultural uses and industrial uses. And that would be fine because even the people who are most concerned about global warming don't think that we need to necessarily immediately get to a complete banning or of the use of fossil fuels. We just have to cut deeply. So what you'd find over time is that more fossil fuels will be more appropriately used in areas where it's hard to make substitutes in the future, and I think farming is likely to be one of those areas.
I appreciate that answer. That's an excellent answer, and I thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne, for the call.
Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye. Let's go to an email. Brian from Elkhorn. I recall reading somewhere, I don't know where, that all forms of energy generation in the country receive some subsidies. It seems disingenuous to suggest that developing renewable energy sources should be competitive without subsidies against established polluting energy sources that receive subsidies.
He's absolutely right. There's no problem with that. My preferred solution would be to get rid of all subsidies and let the best technologies win. We do have huge amounts of subsidies going to oil, natural gas, coal, and so forth. But on the flip side, there have been considerable subsidies gone to renewable fuels as well, and not even subsidies, but as you know, a lot of states are now requiring what they call mandates for green energy, that some percentage of electricity will have to be produced that way, which is in itself also a kind of a subsidy because you're guaranteeing them some price and so forth. But I would prefer just to get rid of them all and have a level playing field and see what happens at that point. But politically, again, I don't think that's likely to happen, to be honest with you.
Jim from Milwaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Mainly I want to talk about nuclear, but just quickly, you know, I'm reminded of the Fram oil filter commercial where if you pay now or you pay later. So I want us to get going on this. And also, given the global warming issues, can we afford to wait for new technology or should we plunge ahead? Regarding nuclear, First off, of course, there's a continuing problem of disposal. There's also, I've read somewhere that low-level radiation can be a danger to young children, which concerns me. And finally, something that people aren't talking about too much, but it's just a matter of the containment of the structures in the event of an earthquake. I read somewhere that some of the structures in California are built on fault lines, and also the New Madrid fault, supposedly, when that goes, and it will go eventually, it generates more powerful earthquakes than are generated in California, ones that can reach extensively throughout the Midwest and could possibly rupture some new facilities are being built. And so that's a worry to me in terms of nuclear.
And all of those are worries to some extent or other. The question, again, is it's all trade-offs. How worried are you about climate change versus how worried are you about nuclear power? One of the things that this may be surprising to you, but the Stuart Brand, who is a very famous environmentalist and a guy who did the Whole Earth Catalog and so forth, has come out more or less in favor of nuclear power. And he's challenging his fellow environmental activists, you know, to think about this, is what is a bigger problem? Is climate change a big problem, or is storing nuclear energy, nuclear waste? And his point is that we're probably going to get a lot better at storing and handling nuclear waste over time. And so even if we have a kind of clunky system now, eventually, a century from now, our descendants, using better technologies and being wealthier, will have a figure out a better way of handling it. In other words, he thinks that we can safely temporarily store nuclear waste without too much problem and then figure out later how to fix it. If again, you think climate change is an immediate problem we have to address.
Well, that's a good point, but it could be that they can develop better ways to contain the waste, but containment in the case of earthquake, I think, is another serious issue.
It is an issue, and I don't know the data on this. One of the most earthquake prone countries in the world is Japan, and they're supplying something like 40% of their electricity by nuclear power, and as far as I know, they haven't had any particular problems with earthquakes. So I think that it's an engineering solution, and again, I don't know if that's been completely solved, but my suspicion is that with enough time, energy, and technology, we can figure out how to solve that as well. But I don't want to say for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Steve from Fort McCoy. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thanks
for
you.
Taking the call.
Sure.
I want to know what happened to hydro energy. I always hear about solar, wind, and that's all dependent on, what sunshine or if the wind's blowing. But we've got, like the Hillsborough area, they've got a dam there and a great big lake. The water's just running over the end, and nobody's thought about even putting a little generator there. It's clean, it's efficient, it's dependable. The Hoover Dam's been running for years, churning out electricity, and we refuse to dam anything up here and get a little electricity out of it. I just wonder why.
Well, it's a good question. My understanding, again, talking to people in the energy field, one of the things in the United States is we've dammed up pretty much all of the big sites anymore. We're not going to get a huge bang for the buck. Though, as you point out, you could get micro hydropower at local dams and that kind of thing. But a bigger issue, again, is the trade-off problem, is that a lot of people in the environmental community are very strongly against further dams. They want rivers to run free, for environmental reasons, to allow fish to have natural habitats and so forth. And you have to, again, there's no free lunch. You have to figure out what it is that you think is the bigger problem. And as you know, it's a not in my backyard kind of problem right now with a lot of these kinds of things. A lot of people don't want dams, any more dams on rivers and streams. And a lot of people don't want wind farms near them either because they think they're unsightly or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a huge, not in my backyard problem, there's a huge controversy going on in California right now because a large number of companies want to build the kind of solar thermal electric generation plants I'm talking about in the desert, and there are a lot of people in the environmental community who are going, oh, no, you can't do that. You'll hurt the desert fauna and flora. And it's a trade-off. You have to decide what there's no free lunch. You have to decide what's more important to you, what issue is more threatening to the environment than another. And there's no escaping those kinds of trade-offs. You simply are not going to be able to have all good things at no cost.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, an email from Ron from River Falls. Can you comment if you've seen it, but you can comment even if you haven't seen it, a January 2008 article in Scientific American supporting a massive switch from coal to solar power plants in the southwest U.S. The article suggests 35% of total energy needs could be provided by such plants by 2050. A new direct current distribution system would be required to deliver the solar-generated power across the country.
I haven't seen this specific article, but I'm a subscriber to the Scientific American. Well, anyway, again, I think that there's a good chance that that is possible to do. I do note that the timeline was 2050, was it not?
Right.
This is much longer timeline than was being suggested by the former vice president.
Okay. Let's go next to David calling us from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, morning, Kathleen. And let's see, is this Ronald? Ronald Bailey?
Ronald
yes,
Bailey,
it is.
Yeah, how are you? You know, it's for a magazine, what was it? Reason Magazine. You know, I have to laugh at your answers because it's pretty obvious that you're not dealing with reason. First of all, did I catch it right? You are a skeptic about global warming?
No. Basically, I have been skeptical about global warming, but I basically am not anymore and have come out in favor of a carbon tax as of 4 or 5 years ago. But no.
Oh, okay, good. Because, you know, the people who have wasted our time for the last 30, 40 years and essentially caused the murders
of
millions and millions of people. The energy bill that just passed a couple of months ago is essentially the deaths of hundreds of millions of people. The rise in the price of corn is leading to the deaths in starvation. But the clean coal thing is so ugly. I lived in Colorado in very near Parachute, which is where they want to essentially do more of this so-called clean coal. Anthracite coal, I'm going to guess on the millions of years old. Anthracite, say, is 5 million years old. High sulfur coal is, say, 4 million years old. The stuff in this shale rock out in Parachute is, say, 3 million years old. The sludgy kind of tar sands up in Canada is about 2.5 million years old. In Colorado, they had to boil and grind and boil and grind that shale. And they had to waste 50% of the energy to get 50% of the energy back. But what made it worse was they were going to pollute 20 gallons of water in order to get every 1 gallon of energy out, or any, you know, the equivalent of oil and gas. So they were going to have to waste 20 gallons of water, and they would have to then create a dam to hold that completely poisonous 20 gallons of water to be able to produce 1 gallon of fuel. What made it worse was they're hoping to get billions of gallons of fuel, so that means 20 times billions of storage, and that would be on the Colorado River, which runs through the Grand Canyon. It runs through Grand Junction, which is an agricultural area. It goes down to Arizona, which becomes highly agricultural. The Central Valley in California, highly agricultural. You have a dam holding hundreds of billions of gallons of highly toxic water, wastes, and that dam busts open. Look at the Po River before the Soviet Union fell. That blew out 16 dams and damaged their high agricultural area in the Ukraine.
All right, I need to hold you there, David. We have a lot of calls coming in. Ronald.
I'm... What can I say? I'm not sure you're characterizing the plant in Colorado completely correctly, but I'm not in favor of that. And if you've been reading Reason Magazine, you will have seen that we have been opposing the bioethanol mandate, and you're correct that this particular mandate is helping starve hundreds of millions of people. and was at one point favored by the environmental community, or some portions of it, the Natural Resources Defense Council, among others. But we've been opposing it since it was proposed. And you would have found out why if you'd been reading the magazine, if I may give you that plug.
All right. You may. Thanks very much for the call. An email from Dave from Madison. To move out of the carbon economy to the alternative energy economy is the greatest business opportunity ever open to the world. The cost of making this move will be offset many times by creating even more wealth and jobs. It's the only way to avoid the collapse of the natural infrastructure of the planet.
Perhaps there's some truth to that in an odd way. One of the problems that you always have is again, a trade-off. What you're having to do, for example, I make this point in the article very briefly, is that some people will certainly make money by doing this kind of thing. On the other hand, lots of people will lose money as well, and it's going to be a trade-off again. One of the things... for example, scrapping the entire, if we were to go with the vice president, former vice president's plan, scrapping the entire electric generation system, essentially, in the United States, would not be cost-free. And so these things have to be borne in mind. It may be a great business opportunity, but it's not going to be a cost-free business opportunity.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest is Ronald Bailey, science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com, where he writes a weekly science and technology column. And we're looking at his piece, July 29, Al Gore's curiously cost-free plan to repower America, calculating the cost of 100% renewable carbon-free energy in 10 years. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the author of The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. The author, Michael Meyer, first went to China in 1995 with the Peace Corps, and he has been a longtime teacher, an award-winning writer for travel writing, and he will be with us tomorrow, the day before the Olympics start. All right, back to phone calls. Stafford is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Stafford.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to comment on the plug-in electric cars, and I'm pretty sure that you guys know this, but I think it's important for the listeners to hear that obviously talk of plug-in electric cars is premature until the power generation plants become more environmentally sound. Otherwise, you're just plugging your car in to a coal-powered plant.
I believe that that's absolutely correct, though there is an interesting feature that goes with that that would have some environmental benefits. There was a study done, and again, it's an engineering study, and costs are usually not completely all captured by engineering studies, but there was a study done in 2006 by the U.S. Department of Energy, and I describe it very briefly, and I link to it in my article, that found that essentially if you could convert 84%, I don't know why specifically 84% of all the cars and light trucks into plug-in electric vehicles, fueling them would not require any additional electric generation capacity at all. Why? Because you could use off-peak power. You could keep the electric power plants running during the night, and they would be able to supply the extra energy to run, you know, essentially at least 80% of our vehicle fleet. And what's interesting about that is that you could then offset 52% of our oil imports. So what that does is it provides a little bit of energy security, but it also would reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that would be released by the cars moving around. But you're right. Currently, it wouldn't be a huge environmental benefit, but it would have some energy security benefits.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Stafford, for your call. Fran from Ellison Bay is next. Hi, Fran.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to thank you for this wonderful informational program. And the main point it's making is the complexity of our problem and how to solve it. And I wanted to particularly point out one particular idea that was promoted by Barack Obama, I believe, in a recent speech, that we should all reduce our consumption of electrical power by 15%. But in that same speech, he said he would subsidize to, I don't know how much, the automakers to increase the production of hybrid cars. Now, I like to ask, and I think this problem might have been brought into you before, but can you imagine the effect on our electrical system when millions of hybrid cars plug in order to provide transportation for their next day and charging their batteries? You can say they could use it at various hours of the night and things of that sort, but it would be a tremendous pressure on our electrical system. Okay, all I'm just saying is we just need to take our time and try every suggestion that is brought. Use American ingenuity and American patience and American working together to solve this problem, no one fighting the other. That's all, and I just want to thank you for the program to point out to us in all humility that it is really very, very complex. Thank you
so
much.
As many things are. Thank you, Fran, for the call. Ronald.
Again, I think that using these Energy Department estimates, it would be possible that our electrical system could withstand a switch to plug-in electric vehicles over the next decade or so. But again, if you look at Barack Obama's speech, he was basically suggesting that we would get a million of these vehicles on the road over the next decade or so. And our vehicle fleet is somewhere in the neighborhood of almost 200 million. So that's really a very tiny percentage. It's not a very ambitious goal on his part, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for your call. We go next to Christina calling from Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've got two questions. I chose geothermal to heat and cool my 13,500 square foot equestrian facility. It's a big horse barn.
Oh.
I attended an energy fair and was told that the geo could also produce electricity. Are you familiar with that?
On a local level, no, I'm not.
Oh, okay. I guess I need further study on that then. My other question is, have you evaluated the maglev wind turbines? They're designed more like what reminds me of a squirrel cage versus color type.
I know what you're talking about. Yes, it's a good image.
Oh, okay. Well, can you tell me about that?
Well, the idea is that they're frictionless, of course, and therefore you would lose a lot less power, and they would be able to run much more efficiently over time, and they could also run with less wind. So they would be more efficient. They're also much more technically difficult to maintain. So, again, there are these trade-offs, but I'm not going to say no. It's a possibility.
So from what I understand, that it'll power like 750,000 homes with one turbine versus 1,000 windmills.
That seems unlikely, but I'll have to look into that.
Okay. All right. Do you have a website where I can go and get additional information about your studies?
Well, as I do with all my articles, I link to everything that has a factual basis, so you'll be able to look it up yourself. The article is at reason.com, and again, it's Al Gore's Curiously Cost-Free Plan to Repower America.
Okay, great.
And let me ask you, Christina, what made you go in the direction of a geothermal equestrian center, and was it very expensive for you?
Well, actually, it turned out to be very efficient for me. I mean, the initial cost is greater than what I would have initially if I went with a furnace or a wood burner. But I was even talking to my energy company, who was just very impressed with how low my energy bills are. So it is. It's clean. I wanted something clean. I wanted something safe. I didn't want fire in the facility, and I also put a living area in here, and you get free air along with that because it's coming directly out of the ground, or I should say virtually free.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at several different types of heating and cooling, and I worked very closely with Focus on Energy because I wanted to make this facility as energy efficient as I possibly could for myself personally and just for, you know, to reduce my carbon footprint.
Right. Good for you.
I think that's a great idea. Could I also ask a question? Because I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any tax benefits to this?
You know, unfortunately, there were no tax benefits.
Okay.
The geothermal, because they were talking about the initial cost. However, we encouraged some friends that were building a new home. right. in the geothermal, and with the way LP costs are, they are so thankful they did, because that will turn their energy costs around very quickly. You know, their the cost that the net cost
right.
for having done that. So however, there were some other things that I had installed here as well, as far as the efficient lighting and all, that did have rebates with it.
Thank you so much for the call. And I know there have been schools, I don't know if these are widespread around the country, but it is interesting how many smaller units are going to geothermal. We have several of them in Wisconsin. And if my memory serves me right, I think they did get tax breaks for changing their schools to geothermal.
Right. Well, one of the things that, again, one of the problems with a lot of the local, and it's only a problem if you're short of cash, is that the capital costs, again, up front are more expensive than the current conventional type. So what happens is you have to figure out if you're building a new house or something, if you want to tack on the extra, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to get this, and then earn it out later in lower energy costs. And again, I think more people are going to move in that direction as energy prices go up.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Zana, is it, or Zana from West Salem? Hi, Zana. Zana.
Hi, Zana.
Zana. Hi, Zana.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I have a question. In the late 80s or early 90s, my dad had invested in a company that was doing research on long-life batteries that were powered by decomposing nuclear waste. And... yeah, obviously, at the time, the problem was packaging it, but I was wondering if anything has ever really come out of that, or if it's just...
I think we would have heard if it had.
I think so. It sounded like it. You know, they had accomplished their mission. It was just basically the packaging.
It sounds to me like something that would be more useful for space type of applications.
Okay.
But not something you'd want to use on the Earth, because we already have a battery disposal problem.
Yeah, well, I looked at the prospectus, and they were looking at, use other than, here on Earth kind of thing, like, hand flashlights, that kind of stuff. And all I could think of was, someone loses their flashlight, and there it sits.
Right.
So, okay, well, that's all I wanted to know.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
We go to Jim from Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hi. My question is simply this. Of all the other forms of energy other than nuclear, essentially the plants can run until they break down, and that can be solved by maintenance. And when the plant is no longer useful, you can walk away, and you've got a Hulk in the desert and big deal. But nuclear plants have a finite life because of the nature of the radioactivity and the fact that the plants eventually become radioactive, and they must be decommissioned, which is expensive. We're not even talking about disposal of waste, which is another cost. I want to know if he took the decommissioning costs and the life cycle of the plants into his cost calculation.
And the figures I was using did say that they did take those costs and the decommissioning costs specifically, and they were not taking the fuel costs into account over time. But yes, they did take the decommissioning. And the way that we set it up in the United States, I don't know elsewhere, is that all the plants for every year they operate have to set aside a certain amount of money for paying for the decommissioning costs at the time that the plant's life cycle is over. So that is usually taken into account already for the existing plants anyway.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. One more email. We're almost out of time. I don't want to pay about 15% more for my electricity to get it for wind power, but I choose to do so as the guest ponders, because I am willing to pay extra for the greater good of our society and our world.
Well, and that's fine. It's a great choice, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, we all make those kinds of choices every day. But just as to end up on a what I think is an imponderable, one of the problems is that while we in the United States are going to be able to adopt these technologies, and they're relatively more expensive, and we would be willing perhaps to pay more for the power and the electricity they produce. One of the things you have to keep in mind is that there's still 2 billion people on the planet who have never so much as turned on a light switch. The current projections I've seen in Africa, even in the next 25 years, half the people still won't have access to modern fuels.
Goodness.
So the problem is that are we going to try to impose on them these relatively more expensive fuel sources, or will we allow them to go ahead with their development using cheaper carbon-based fuels for the time being? Yeah. And I think that's a real imponderable.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ronald, so much. What an interesting hour.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed chatting with you and your guests.
Thank you. Ronald Bailey, science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He writes a weekly science and technology column. The piece we were referring to today in July 29 in Reason, Al Gore's curiously cost-free plan to repower America, calculating the cost of 100% renewable carbon-free energy in 10 years. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls and for listening. We'll have news ahead, many more hours of great conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.